Hi everyone, welcome to Meetings with Remarkable Humans. I've been thinking about doing this podcast program for a while. I've been a heavy podcast listener for years, music, culture, comedy, history, all sorts of things, but I never really found academic podcasts fun to listen to. Not because the ones out there aren't great, but there's always this vaguely professional quality to them, like you're about to sit through another lecture, and that's exactly what I didn't want to do. Thinking back, some of the most genuinely inspiring moments in my earlier years came from long, unstructured conversations with friends. And those kinds of conversations became harder and harder to have. There's always a reason not to, and rarely a reason to. This podcast is the reason. The more immediate trigger for actually starting it was moving back to China at the end of 2025, after nearly a decade living abroad. I joined the Threats of Computational Media and Arts at HKUST Guangzhou, a genuinely unusual place that's brought together people across disciplines, fields, and continents. I quickly realized that what interested me about my colleagues wasn't primarily their academic credentials, but it was their life stories and how those stories shaped their particular ways of seeing technology and art. That's what this show is really about, not just what remarkable people have achieved, but what made them the way they are. And the same curiosity extends to friends I've made over the years, many of whom I've barely seen since we all got busy. This podcast is also an excuse to reconnect. The format is deliberately loose. These aren't interviews in any conventional sense. I will ask whatever is on my mind, which might have nothing to do with anyone's job. I'll talk about my own work when it comes up, but I'm not committed to staying on topic. Some episodes will be in Chinese, some in English. All opinions are purely those of me and my guests and don't represent any institution. The very first guest of this program is Mark Grimshaw Aughott, a remarkable human in every sense. He's lived across multiple continents since a very young age, worked underground in mines as a young man, trained as a musician, became a sound engineer, and toured with famous musicians, and then found his way into research through the very specific and unique topic of sound in video games. From there, he built out into one of the most comprehensive scholarly understandings of sound I've come across, spanning engineering, perception, and philosophy. A huge thank you to Mark for being willing to try this with me, for helping me set up the mics and even testing the whole recording setup, and for making fried rice after 3+ hours of conversation. I hope you enjoy getting to know Mark, and I hope this rambling conversation is worth your time. This is the first time for both of us to try this. I didn't have a specific script, so this is far from perfect. It wasn't intended to be. More than anything, this is a record of a conversation between two people who I hope I can say that genuinely enjoyed each other's presence. So I hope you can enjoy this conversation too. And so today is the very first attempt with Professor Mark Grimshaw Aughott. Is that pronunciation?
Close enough.
Okay. So Mark is an Obel professor of music.
I was the Obel professor of music at Aalborg University for 13 years before coming here, and right. I'm currently professor emeritus there.
Right, professor emeritus. Yeah, and now you are working at CMA.
Yes,
HQST, Guangzhou.
I've been here a year and a half now.
Why don't you just introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure.
Yeah.
Where would you like me to start? From the day I was born, or
or maybe first of all, just your briefly about your research interests or the area that you work in.
Okay. Yeah. My research interests. Well, my PhD, which I did at the University of Waikato, completed in 2007, was entitled The Acoustic Ecology of the First-Person Shooter. So I clearly spent a lot of time playing first-person shooter games, particularly games like Doom and Quake and Quake 3 Arena around about that time and so on. So I was interested in how the relationship between the perception of sound, if you like, and the video game design, the visual design and so on, gave the impression of presence or immersion in computer games to first-person shooters. I'm particularly interested in first-person perspective games because of the obviously, well, the first-person perspective and how that works with the at the time, stereo audio. So that was my PhD, and I did a lot of publishing after that on the topic, particularly moving more and more towards immersion and presence, meaning of sound in virtual reality and virtual environments such as computer games. And from that, I got interested in things like perception of sound, what sound actually is, because it struck me that the acoustics, natural science definitions of sound were not up to the job in terms of explaining the relationship between a sound wave and the sound that we perceive. I'm sure we will discuss that later on and so on. I've also done some publishing on bibliometrics, a little bit and so on. That's a developing area. I've done some publishing on the Uncanny Valley with one of my PhD students about 15 years ago now, I think. And I've recently started getting interested in the implications for artificial intelligence, particularly the large language models, and how it relates to my very early research, which was presence, about the self, and so on. So in some ways, I'm coming full circle, but moving on to different subject matter.
Right. And famously, what does it feel like to be an AI? Right. That's your recent project and your talk here, and then as the title of your recent publication as well.
Famous already. Yeah. What is it like to be an AI? That will be published later this year.
Right.
It's already been accepted, and that's coming out in the Palgrave Handbook of the Phenomenology of Media, which should be coming out later on this year and so on. And I have a couple of other papers in the same area that I'm co-authoring with one of my PhD students, if I can give a shout-out to him, Alex B, who came over
Bia?
From... Alex Bia.
Bia?
Sorry. Bia. Yeah. Bia, I should say. I'm not really Danish. So Alex Bia, who came over from Aalborg University as well. He was one of my undergraduate and master's students and arrived here about 6 months after me.
And in research direction-wise, you moved from game studies at first with a focus on sound, if I can say that, and then to more about sound, and then concepts about sound, virtuality, uncanny, and you'd also talked about uncanny of sound, right, at some point. Yes.
The audio uncanny.
Yeah, the audio uncanny, yes. Yeah. And then presence, immersion, or AR, AI as a latest.
Yes, I've had an academic career that reaches back 40 years, actually, now.
Right.
I actually did my first teaching at a university while I was still an undergraduate, strangely enough. They were very different days in those days. So I was teaching in the early 1980s. So my first degree was music.
Right.
I majored in electroacoustic composition, which is where I got interested in analog in those days, and then the early days of digital with things like the Yamaha DX7. So I did my final project on this 4-year degree was electroacoustic composition. And then I went off to do an MSc in music technology at the University of York, and that's really where I got my first taste of computer programming. And again, my thesis there was a mix of a whole load of computer programs for what was then known as the composer's desktop project. So lots of stuff to do with FFTs, fast Fourier transforms, and manipulating the spectral qualities of the sound and so on, and then resynthesizing it back into music or sound effects, soundscapes and stuff like that. So I was interested in doing that. This, of course, was the days of the Atari 1040 ST, if anyone of your listeners is old enough to remember what was known as a musician's computer at the time and so on. And after that, I worked for a couple of years as a sound engineer in Italy, in various studios in Milan, in addition to doing sort of roadie gig work for people like Tina Turner, people like Wayne Shorter, some of the jazz greats, Carmen McRae, Steve Gadd, Al Jarreau, and so on.
Ask you more about this.
Interesting
later.
People to talk to, and so on. And then I decided that I needed to get back into academia, so I ended up doing some part-time work at Exeter University in the UK before getting a full-time job at Salford University for the next 10 years on a popular music and recording course. It was while I was there that I got interested in playing lots of computer games. And I had loads of servers in my office running Quake 3 Arena and Urban Terror, Castle Wolfenstein, and so on. And I suggested to one of my colleagues that wouldn't it be an interesting idea to start an undergraduate degree in computer and video games? And we did this, and it actually turned out to be one of the first, if not the first, undergraduate degree in that topic in the world, I believe. And now you have computer games and video game degrees everywhere. Right.
When you say you were teaching as an undergrad, was that this period?
Or? I was teaching as an undergraduate students in popular music and recording.
Right.
So I was doing things like a music composition, but also working in the recording studio, still in the days of reel-to-reel tape, although we began the move to ADAT, which is sort of, well, it's not tapeless, but it is digital. And then later on to things like Cubase and Logic Audio. So Cubase VST, if I remember correctly, and Logic Audio, the digital systems and so on. So I was working on that, and I had my first PhDs while I was there. The degree in computer and video games was an undergraduate degree, and that got me interested.
Okay.
And my teaching on that was to do with sound design in computer games. So you begin to see the connection from the music, electroacoustic music, through to MSc in music technology and programming, and so on, through to sound engineering and recording, through to computer games, particularly the sound design of computer games. You see a connection from that all the way through to what became my PhD topic, which was acoustic ecology or the first-person shooter.
Right. So before working on sound in games, you were working, I guess, in sound or music more as a professional sound engineer, I would say. And then before that, musician at some point. You mentioned you played the trumpet at some point.
I used to play the trumpet, My undergraduate degree was in South Africa. And South Africa, for anyone who knows anything about jazz, is one of the big, big jazz centers and certainly has been from around about the 1940s, 1950s. Some of the big names, Hugh Masekela, Dollar Brand or Abdullah Ibrahim and so on come out of that. Dudu Pukwano and so on. So I was really interested in jazz. And one of my lecturers at the university, which was the University of Natal in Durban, now University of KwaZulu-Natal, was one of Dave Brubeck's sons, Darius Brubeck. He was one of the jazz lecturers there. And a lot of his brothers were actually there playing in the orchestra, doing this, that, and ever. So it was a very, very vibrant jazz scene in South Africa. So I played a lot of jazz, a lot of South African jazz, which is a bit different to American-style jazz, but clearly there's a fair bit of overlap going on there. But I haven't played trumpet for about 30 years now.
Right. If you pick it up now, can you still?
I doubt it very much. anyone who plays any brass instrument knows you need to work on the embouchure and your lip muscles and mouth muscles and so on. It's gone. It's gone.
Yeah. Okay, I guess by now our audience would have a rough big picture of your career trajectory from music technology, music engineer, and then to research, starting from sound in games. And before we talk more about your work, I think why don't you tell us more about your personal journey, personal history, because you have a complicated name and people might wonder what does each part come from. So
I was born in England, left after a few weeks, couple of months maybe, to Nassau in the Bahamas in the Caribbean. My parents were teachers and my father worked for British Overseas Aid, so I don't remember anything of NASA. I don't remember travelling all over America and Canada by car. I don't remember any of that and so on. But after about 3 years, 4 years in NASA, we then moved on to Kenya in Nairobi, and we were there for about 8.5 years. I went to school there, and then we moved on to Botswana. After that, I then actually started, when I finished school, studying a Bachelor of Engineering in Mining Engineering. So I worked in the coal and gold mines in South Africa.
How old were you back then?
I was 18, 19. Okay. So I started an undergraduate degree after school in mining engineering at Rand Mines College, I think it was, in Johannesburg. But I made a big mistake. Yeah, I did that because I wanted to stay in Botswana, and I didn't want to be a teacher like my parents. And now look at me. Yeah, I really enjoy teaching. But at the time, I didn't want to be a teacher. And really, the only other possibility for me was to really work in the mines. There were a lot of mines, diamond, copper, gold, coal, etc. in Botswana. And I wanted to move back there. So I chose to do mining engineering. But after 6 months of going deep underground, crawling around on my stomach, 2 kilometres underground, listening to rocks cracking above me, I decided no. Yeah, I'm sure anyone who's been underground would appreciate what I felt and so on. So the thing that I had done really well in school at was music. So I was playing trumpet, I was very good at music theory, so I had an interview with the local university, the University of Natal, and got in, surprisingly. So that was the next 4 years of my life, and then on to the MSc in Music Technology, I said. So that was South Africa for about 4 or 5 years, and then on to England for 1 year, doing my MSc, then Italy for a couple of years, where I worked as a sound engineer and working on tours with various musicians, and then back to England for about 11 years. And then I decided to go off and explore New Zealand. So I resigned my job at Salford University, went off to New Zealand. I toured around the country for 6 months on a motorbike, and then spent all my money and decided I needed to get a job. So I got a job at a higher education institute down at the bottom, where I was an academic manager. I didn't really enjoy academic management. I really wanted to do teaching and the possibility to do some research. So I thought maybe now is a time to do a PhD. So from that previous job, I saved us some money, so I went off and did a PhD at the University of Waikato in Hamilton in New Zealand, and did that, if I can boast for a little while. I'm one of the very few people to get through a PhD with no revisions. The only other person I know is actually one of my PhD students after that and so on. So so I'm quite proud of that.
Right. And you also allowed that record to be matched by your student, I guess.
By one of my students, yes, Angela Tindwell, who was very interested in the Uncanny Valley. So after that, I then moved back to England for about 4 years, working in a couple of universities as an academic manager, and then I managed to get back into teaching and research as a reader. And on the basis of that, I then got interviewed and accepted finally at Aalborg University in Denmark, as the Obel Professor of Music. Obel, because it was sponsored by a family firm. There's quite a bit of that in Denmark. So a private family charity, if you like, sponsors lots of things. And one of the things they were interested in was music, and they wanted to support the study of music at the university. So I was there for 13 years. I'm a Danish citizen. I'm a New Zealand citizen. I'm also a British citizen. But in Denmark, this is where I met my wife. So my name originally is Mark Grimshaw, which is a very typical Northern English name because I was born in Yorkshire. When I got married to my wife 8 years ago, in 2017.
We can edit this.
We both changed our names to surname Grimshaw Orgel. Right. So my name now is Mark Grimshaw Orgel.
And I mean, you said it's a Northern English name.
Yes.
Which means that you could also be originated from Denmark, or, you know,
indeed. It's difficult to tell where the name Grimshaw comes from, but if you split it into Grimm's Howl or Grimm's Have, it could be Grimm, which is a name of a person, like, for example, the fairy tale collectors, the Brothers Grimm. And Heve or Hau is either lake or sea, or it could be field or garden. Mm. In other words, Grimm's house, if you like, or Grimm's farm. Mm. That's where it comes from. So it could be that eventually ending up in Denmark.
Right.
I am originally of Viking stock. Who knows? I like to think that.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell that from you somehow. Yeah. And then what's in common between us, I guess, I've also worked in Denmark for a while. So I did my postdoc in Denmark and from early 2024 to late 2025. So I was in Aarhus. I was told it was the second largest city of Denmark.
I think it is, yes, yeah. Whereas Aalborg is the fourth largest, I think.
Oh, what's the third?
Odense, I think.
It's because they have the island, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. It depends how you calculate these things, yes.
Yeah, it's, as you were describing your earlier experience, I was just thinking that you said you worked in a mine for like 6 months, and you later studied sound in first-person shooter or computer games, and then you described sound in games as described
acoustic
the game
ecology.
As a acoustic ecology. Yeah. Yes, and I kept thinking that you spent 6 months in a mining cave. Would that be like a you know the origin of the perception of going into a space with a entirely different? Yeah.
Well, I was also
experience.
Sitting in a classroom studying geology and engineering, mechanics, and stuff like that, and so on. I think the last thing I was thinking about down the mines when I was crawling about on my stomach and so on with all the noise going on there, it's very, very noisy and so on. The last thing I was thinking about was sound. Okay. I have to say, the last thing I was thinking about, yeah,
right.
Maybe I was thinking, I hope I get out of here alive today.
Who knows? Maybe I'm just thinking that just the very experience of that
maybe
might have
maybe.
Had an imprint
maybe.
On, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe, maybe, maybe it is certain. Certainly, if I think back to that, it's a very different soundscape, acoustic ecology, to what most people experience all their lives, which is a lot of open space, whereas down in the mine, you are closed in. Mm. It is a very different reverberant setting, echoey setting, and of course, because of all the machinery and drilling going on there and occasionally explosions, it's very, very noisy.
Right, yeah. I would say that it might be interesting to experience, but I guess it's not that pleasant to.
No. But you can go on a tour down a gold mine.
Okay.
If you go to South Africa or somewhere, you can go on a tour.
Right.
Very safe.
Yeah. And then you say these days that you don't want to you want to avoid going to like loud gigs and stuff because you want to protect your hearing. Is that also from that kind of experience that did you have? Hearing damage? Or
no. Well, you know, I'm 62 years old. I'm sure I got hearing damage. I've worked as a sound engineer.
Yeah.
I've worked in live gigs and I've worked in very loud jazz bands and so on. As a trumpeter, you stand at the front and behind you, you have the drum kit, you have the bass amplifiers and also all sorts of things going on. Yeah?
Yes, yes.
So I'm quite certain I've probably got some hearing damage. So what I have left, I want to protect.
Right. Yeah. I have friends who work in the music industry, and then when they set up the music venue, and then they would typically make the sound much louder than what I would prefer. And I don't know if it's for the effect of the, you know, the liveness, or it's just because they cannot hear the details.
I guess it all depends on how loud it was, the size of the speakers, the room, and so on. But there is this belief that those who go to concerts, particularly rock and pop concerts, and or go to dance clubs, for example, want to actually physically feel the music. And for that, you not only need a good bass, but you need a high intensity, a high amplitude, and so on.
Yeah.
So there is actually quite a few studies done on hearing loss among sound engineers, among musicians, and of course those who regularly go to particularly dance clubs, trance clubs,
raves
and stuff like that, and so on.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some.
When you're young,
you
live forever.
Yes.
You will hear forever, you will live forever.
So then touching on when you were working as a sound engineer, because you said you work with Tina Turner, with Wayne Shorter.
Not as a sound engineer.
Not as
a, working on the tours.
Okay.
So helping them with the tours and so on. Translating Italian, English, because this was in Italy at the time. Driving them around wherever they wanted to go, making sure all the instruments and everything was set up on stage that they wanted.
Right.
So, general dog's body roadie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I want to say I almost had a similar experience when I was studying in Australia, and then there was one Chinese band wanted to tour there, and then I was looking for potential venues for them, and then if it actually happened, I would have been a roadie with them. But it didn't happen.
I was one member of a team.
Right.
My sound engineer side was done in a studio. After that.
Right. Any interesting stories or notable memories from your years as a roadie with the
not really as a roadie, but as a sound engineer, I guess a lot of studios at the time did this in the downtime between recording some of the big Italian bands and so on. We also did a lot of language tapes. And this was in the days of reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah.
So we recorded on Studer machines. Gosh, I even forget the name of the other machine and so on. But Studer machines, reel-to-reel, A77 comes to mind and so on. Revox, I think they were. Yeah. So quarter-inch tape, stereo tricks. So, and I did a lot of Chinese to Italian. Yeah. Oh. My Italian was reasonably good. It's pretty easy for an English speaker to learn, I think, Italian. But Chinese, whether it's Cantonese or Mandarin or something, is quite a bit more different. But if you can imagine, you are recording the speaker who's reading out the lessons and so on. They're doing it in Italian. They're also doing it in Mandarin or Chinese and so on. You don't understand Mandarin or Chinese. They make a mistake. Somehow you have to...
okay.
Instead of stopping recording, you say, okay, go again, and you make a note, this is now the second attempt, go again, make this the third attempt. So when you come back to edit it, you cut the tape, you splice out, or you take out, you remove the section that was a mistake, and splice them together.
Yeah.
So can you imagine the sound engineer not understanding Cantonese?
You're also in charge of editing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I would imagine that they would have someone who understands the language to do that.
Sometimes, but she wasn't always there. So I sometimes wonder whether what they actually ended up with, the poor Italians trying to learn Cantonese or Mandarin, I sometimes wonder whether they actually ended up with the correct Cantonese or Mandarin.
Yeah, I guess that's
true. I'm sure I did a very professional job as best as I could, but still.
Otherwise, a few generations of Italians would have learned the wrong word. Of Chinese,
coming to China, wondering why they're not understood.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So you did the language recording.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were Mandarin, Chinese, there was French, there was English, there was German, all sorts of languages. Mm. Obviously with Italian, because it was in Italy, being the common base.
Right. Yeah. And so when you're working as a sound engineer, were you working primarily in Italy or elsewhere as well?
Yes.
In Italy. Okay.
Yeah. So it was about a year and a half after I did the touring and so on, I worked as a sound engineer in a couple of studios in Italy, in Milan.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
These were the days of big, big studios with big, big desks.
Yeah. And I guess these days things might be a bit different. As we were setting up the recording room, and then you were saying, you don't really recognize these equipment.
Exactly.
But I guess these days people, they're still... So first of all, there are people still doing either experimental music or sound experiments. They would use physical tapes still, and I guess they will look for these recording studios that still are equipped with those equipment.
Yes, or they would buy their own machines and fix them and keep them up. I don't know how many people are still working with the old analog reel-to-reel tape technology. There will be some people who prefer using it. But these days I get the impression that things are mostly digital.
Yeah.
There is something very physical about handling tape. This is when you go back to people like Pierre Schaeffer, who started working more mainly with vinyl first,
right,
and then with tape, and did a lot of interesting experience. He was a person who first came up with the term, I believe, musique concrète, and so on, one of the early pioneers of electroacoustic music from the early 1940s onward and so on. One of the early pioneers and one of the early theorists of musique concrète, electroacoustic music and so on, and the idea of a sound object in many ways comes from the idea that you can have a piece of tape which is a physical object. And what it is the recording of the sound wave on it, and so on. And because of the speed of the tape, and because also of the direction, you can reverse it and so on, it is really like an object. You can cut up. You can reassemble in different ways. You can reverse it so that the sound you then get reproduced goes backwards and so on. So in many ways, it is a sound object. You don't really get that with digital consoles, digital audio workstations these days. They try to reproduce the, particularly the control bar down at the bottom, like the old tape machine. So you've got a play button, you've got a stop button, record, a pause button, fast forward, fast rewind, and so on. They try to reproduce that, but so many people these days have no idea what a reel-to-reel tape machine is, or let alone what it actually looks like and so on, that is completely divorced now and so on. So, again, on a digital audio workstation, a multi-track digital audio workstation, you also have the concept of tracks. And this comes from reel-to-reel, where you move from mono to stereo on quarter inch and so on, and then you might have four tracks on 1 inch or half inch, and then eight tracks, and then on to 16, and then 24, I think that was the maximum, on 2 inch wide tape. And there you have the idea of tracks.
I see, yeah, it's really interesting that how, as the medium changed, the, I guess, possibilities of playing around with recording concepts also changed. I think I'm vaguely aware of some early experiments of or explorations of recording, like, so for example, the pianist Glenn Gould, he used to be a I guess pioneer in exploring the recording of classical music for his own playing, and then I think he preferred mono over stereo or something, and then he also did some recording experiments of, well, I guess just playing with the medium of himself talking and then radio as well.
If I remember correctly, Glenn Gould was also one of the early pioneers in classical music performance. He did a lot of Bach, for example, his Goldberg Variations. I think I got three or four different versions of that recorded. Actually, it's beautiful music and so on. But he was one of the early pioneers in tape editing. Of course, when he did a previously a classical recording, you played the whole piece all the way through. There are mistakes, you either accepted them or you went back and did the whole thing again. So he was one of the early pioneers in actually assembling multiple takes of the one piece and then putting it together and so on. And you can occasionally hear slight differences in the volumes and flow between phrases, but you need to listen very, very carefully. So he was, as you say, he was one of the early pioneers. One of the interesting things, differences between digital audio workstation and tape, of course, is that when you cut a tape in order to remove a section, splice it to the following section, for example, there's a little error, you bang the microphone, you can, or there's a little in your voice or whatever, you can cut that out, that tiny little section there, is if it's got multiple tracks on it, 2, 4, 8, 16 or 24 tracks, you cannot actually manipulate the individual track.
Because you need to sync them?
Because you're cutting with a razor blade.
Right.
So all 24 tracks will be cut.
Yeah.
And then you splice. If you think of a digital audio workstation, let's say you're also using 24 tracks, although these days I believe it's unlimited according to memory and so on.
Yeah.
If you also have 24 tracks, you can manipulate each individual track separately, completely separate from all the other tracks. So you can take out a portion of track 5, for example. And all the other tracks, 1 to 4 and 6 to 24, are unchanged. You cannot do that with tape.
Right.
You cut with a razor blade, you're cutting across all the tracks.
Yeah.
So in many ways, it's a very different way of composing sound music.
Yes.
I like to think, because I'm an old fogey, that it's easy these days. Yeah, it's not easy, I know that. But too many choices.
Yes,
maybe.
And it's more, yeah, exactly. It's more easily accessible.
You can undo.
Yeah, yeah.
Control Z.
Yeah, yeah. and then the fact that, you know, in the past there you would have needed a very elaborate studio to do all the recording functions, but now everything is in this laptop. But I can only see whatever displayed on the screen at the same time, right? Yeah. But there is something great about the perceived affordance of, you know, being able to see what's happening and then quickly jump on it. Like the fact that we, I can only know that the recording is functioning well by looking at the little LED lights here, and also find the recording software interface here. Okay, it's still going. And then I can look over there to see the video recording still on. But I can imagine if we're recording with tape, it's very difficult to miss the huge, like, rolling tape, right?
It's difficult to miss that. I would say in many ways a digital audio workstation is almost as much a visual medium as it is an auditory medium. But you're quite right, the tape, you don't really miss, you can't miss the turning of the tape. But also, let's not forget, you also have the view meters. And later LEDs, lights for the voltage unit and so on, for the input, your microphone or whatever, or the line input coming in, on the mixing desk, and also very often on the tape recorder as well. You have the view meters, the needles bouncing up and down and so on.
Yeah.
So it is visual in that respect, but there are not so many flashing lights, and you can't actually see the individual tracks and the waveform appearing as you record and so on, as you can on a digital audio workstation.
Yeah. I mean, you can at least see the interface better, or they're presented in human scale, right? So you can go reach over there to turn a knob and then, you know, check here to see the meter. But now it's like everything is here.
Yeah.
And, like, I know everything is available, but, you know, it kind of lacks that perceived affordance of that you know, I want to just come over here and do something. And then that's
even the tactility.
Yes.
This is why people like to have separate control interfaces, where they can have knobs and sliders and so on that hook up via USB to the DAW, the door.
And also, when you said you can have a sound object, right, a piece of tape with recorded information, and then that just provides you a lot of extra perceived affordance of, you know, how now I can cut it, I can, you know, hook it up here, and then, but with a piece of software representation, I know I can do a million more things with it, but it's just, you know, I could just also not do it. You know, I can just close the laptop.
But there's also something very empowering, about sitting in front of a 2-3 meter wide recording console, with all these machines behind you and around you, your tape machine, maybe a stereo tape machine to do your mastering on, and then all your compressors, racks of compressors and gates and Lexicon 480s and, if I can remember that correctly, your Lark controller for the Lexicon, all these effects and so on you can have there. There's something very empowering. You feel in control.
Yeah,
if you know the technology and so on, whereas everything is sort of so tiny and compressed on a little screen in front of you with a digital audio workstation. It's nice to have knobs to twiddle, It's nice to have faders to move up and down.
I was going
to
say then also you could have racks of these effects.
You could have racks of all of these effects and so on.
Yes. And then
you sit there in your chair and you can swivel up and down the length of the desk and so on. Yeah.
And these things just invite you to physically come over and turn it up
and experiment.
Yes.
I remember when I was doing my music degree, electroacoustic composition, in the studio we had there, we had, I think it was an old Amex console, 24-channel Amex console. We had an Otari 8-channel reel-to-reel, which I think was 1 inch, if I remember correctly. And the pride of place was an ARP 2800, I think, which was a modular synthesizer with four monophonic keyboards, and a matrix patching system. So it was about 1.5 meters wide with four monophonic keyboards underneath, and then about 1.5 meters high of all of these modules that you plugged in, oscillators, VCAs, VCOs, gates, sequencers, compressors, etc., filters, etc., etc. All of these things there, and all of them had flashing lights, and they had matrix. There wasn't any wires you plugged in. There were simply levers you pushed up and down to patch from there over to there, and so on. And what I like to do is turn all the lights off, set a sequence going, and sit there with all the flashing lights as if I were the pilot in a huge big jumbo jet or something like that. Yeah. It's quite amazing. Yeah, you don't get that with a digital audio workstation.
How many sets of that system do you think still exist in the world?
Very few, very few. I heard that it was eventually sold maybe about 13, 14 years ago. So I was using it in the early 1980s, and had been in the studio, I think, for about 3 years before that. I think it was eventually sold about 13, 14 years ago to the editor of a well-known audio journal called Sound on Sound. I think it was. It's very much a collector's item.
Right.
I'm sure he's still keeping it going.
Yeah. Well, that would be great. Yeah, because I've only seen some of these systems in like early, sometimes black and white photos, but never seen a real one. Yeah.
Green flashing lights.
Yeah. So then, I guess we could jump into discussing your research, starting from the beginning of your research journey. So your PhD, could you say that it essentially invented a new field?
Because
you studied the soundscape of first-person shooter games through the lens of acoustic ecology.
Yes, so the acoustic ecology or the first-person shooter.
Right. Because I also remember that you mentioned somewhere that it was the first thesis on...
It was the first published monograph on game audio. One of my colleagues, I guess you might say friendly rivalry at the time when I was doing a lot of publishing in game audio, is Karen Collins, or Casey Collins, as she's now known, Casey, who also published a book on game audio, did her thesis on game audio and so on. And it's every time we meet up, it's a little bit of a sort of laugh. Well, my book came out, as in my book on the acoustic ecology of first person shooter, came out 2 months before your book, but you had the better publisher and so on. And so on. So there's a little bit of rivalry there. So I would say actually perhaps between the two of us, we perhaps started this field, if it's not too boastful to say that and so on, which was looking at the relationship between the player and the sound design in computer games.
And which year was this in?
2007, I think, both of our books came out. That's when I finished my PhD, and my book also came out that year.
Right.
So I think hers was the same year, and so on.
Yeah. So, and then before that, I guess there was the game studies research field.
Game studies, you can possibly date it back to Espen Arseth, who's now at City University in Hong Kong.
You invited him for a talk here.
He came here for a talk here, and I've been for a talk over there, and I've known him in Denmark and so on. He was one of the early pioneers in game studies back in round about 2000, 2001, 2002, about the same time that we started at Salford University this undergraduate degree in computer games, computer and video games, and so on. So you might say that around the world, there was a dawning recognition among academics, for example, and researchers, that computer games were a worthwhile area to study.
Right.
I chose to study because of my background, the sound.
Yeah.
Other people chose to study the sociology, the enjoyment, the pleasure, obviously the graphics and so on, the coding for it and so on.
Yeah. Well, now these days it's a research field of respectable size, I think. So I did my PhD in University of Melbourne in Australia, and in our HCI research group, there were a few people doing game-related studies.
Yeah.
But back then, so you said around 2000...
About 2000, shall we say.
Around 2000, yeah. So what triggered the emergence of this kind of work?
I think the maturing of the computer games industry.
Marked
from the early days of Pong and Space Invader and so on.
But those were like even much older, right?
Yes, so, but academia is always a bit slow.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It's always a little bit behind. So you could say in the 1990s, yeah? I mean, Space Invader was 79 or Pong was 79, early 80s, if I recall correctly, and so on. Through the 1980s, and particularly through the 1990s with the growth of consoles and personal computers, affordable personal computers, there was really an exponential growth, particularly in the 1990s after the crash of the games industry in the 1980s. There was this exponential growth in home computing and game consoles and computers games on your home computers, married with the early days of the internet and the World Wide Web, and people started to get 33K modems, 55K modems, ADSL modems into their home and being able to start doing multiplayer gaming and so on.
Right.
Yeah, I used to do a lot of speed mapping for Quake 3 Arena from the very late 1990s through the early 2000s, where a group of us got online sitting at home and we gave ourselves a theme and said, okay, let's do a mapping. I think the editor was called QE Radiant or QR Radiant at the time and so on. You have 2 hours to do a map, a playable multiplayer map for Quake 3 Arena, and then upload your stuff to a server, and then we'll all play it.
To do a map, you make a map together.
You make a map, you make a level.
Okay,
So you had the free editor, level editor, I think was QE Radiant or QR Radiant, and you have that running on your computer, and you make the map, et cetera, et cetera. You know what the theme is, you do the map, et cetera, and you have to finish it in 2 hours.
Mm.
And then you upload it all to a central server, which were computers sitting in my office, and then about sort of 8, 15 or whatever, how many were there that night, spent the next 3-4 hours playing through these maps and laughing at all the errors and the bugs because you have to do it very, very quickly. So you can't do that without a critical mass in terms of having the computing power at home, in terms of having the networks, in terms of having servers, and therefore get people together. So is this realization? Actually, there's a lot of people finding a lot of enjoyment and a lot of enjoyment together. Yeah, this brings in coding skills, it brings in visual design skills, it brings in music composition skills, it brings in sound design skills, it brings in the whole aspect of, by that time, about 20, 30 years worth of computer game, video game and arcade history. Mm. There's a whole sociology around it. Obviously, there's a whole business side around it and so on. So there's a whole wide set of skills and knowledge that is worthwhile researching and studying, and maybe starting out on university study for students.
Yeah.
Because obviously then, like now, so many people want to work in the games industry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So myself and a colleague went off to all the computer game shows, computer games fairs and so on in London and so on, and spoke to, you know, Sony, Electronic Arts, Codemasters. We toured all their studios and so on, and they donated equipment. They said, okay, we'll provide this editor. We had the early PlayStation PlayStation consoles. We had a lot of those donated to us and so on. So we were actually quite successful in interfacing with industry and putting together this course. Mm. But being academics, of course, we were interested also in the critical theory side of computer games. Mm. So this is around the same time that game studies, which is mainly, you might say, the cultural studies, the critical theory side studies of game studies start. So a lot of things came together.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting thing, since I'm interested in sound. During this process, my colleague and I went off to visit Codemasters down in the south of England. A beautiful studio complex set up, purpose-built, with must have been about sort of 500-600 people working there, all working on all the Codemasters games. And Codemasters, as I remember at the time, was mainly racing games and mainly sports games and so on. So we were shown around this particular room, which had about 50 people in. These are all our visual artists. We're shown around another room, studio, which had about 50 people in front of their desks. These are all our 3D modelers, shown around another room with about sort of 200 people in. These are all our programmers, our coders and so on. Another room with I don't know, 30, 40 people in. These are our play testers, our beta testers and so on. And then a door was opened, and it was a size, half the size of this studio here, maybe a broom cupboard, right. And there was one guy in there, and this was the sound guy.
Yeah.
The early days of computer games, sound and music was very much put off to one side. Mm. Nowadays, there's whole studios and whole million R&B pound and dollar budgets devoted to these things, with full symphony orchestras in some cases brought in. They're almost like Hollywood productions. Things have changed quite
a
bit.
Yes.
This was almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. It's interesting when you're saying the earliest games like Pong and Space Invaders, and they don't have sound, right?
Pong had sound. Space Invaders had sound. I think. I'm trying to remember. I should know. I think the early one was Space Wars, or Asteroids, as it later became known. This was one of the first ones to actually have sound. Mm. The very early Pong, when it was first done, I don't think had sound. I think it was called Tennis for Two or something like that. I think it was done. I may be wrong. I think it was done on an old PDP-11 computer and so on.
At least in the video recordings of it, there's usually no sound. So I don't know if it's recording issue.
Yeah, but Atari then produced a version of it called Pong, which I had. Right. I think it was the Atari 2600 console when I was a child, and I used to play Pong, hook it up to the TV, and it certainly had sound.
But even if it had sound, I guess it's just very simple.
I think it was beep.
Yeah.
Beep. Brrr.
No. Okay. They even have variations.
And that was about it. Yeah, they had variations and so on. And of course, Space Invaders had this sort of classic early example of very simple but highly effective and immersive music. Mm. This dum, 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 dum. That's sped up. Dum, 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 until it got to do 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 do, and you're really sort of gripping the side of the console as the aliens come down closer to you, and this music just grabs you.
Right. Yeah. So they had their sound guy, I guess.
They had their sound guy. There were some very clever sound guys in Japan working for all of these early Taito, for example, and Nintendo, obviously, and so on.
Yeah, I think I might have read an article about this, but I forgot where it was. Yeah,
they basically had to hack the chips.
Yeah.
I believe, if I remember correctly, the early sound for Pong was actually produced from the video sync signal, because there was no sound chip.
Right, so that's whatever sound signal that's already existing in the system.
Not even, but a sound signal tied to the video, to the video chip, to the graphics chip.
Yeah.
Or the graphics chip. I don't know much about the early chip systems and so on. Read Casey Collins.
And then when you started to research in this field, what are the typical subject research? I guess Quake is always a popular game because it's accumulated so many players and communities and practices. Is there anything else?
No. No. As any true gamer knows, the only games worthwhile playing are first-person shooters.
Okay. Yeah?
So I was an absolute fanatic for Quake 3 Arena. particularly, mm-hmm. and various mods based off that. So Half-Life had Counter-Strike, which is a huge big thing these days. Quake 3 Arena had a similar mod called Urban Terror.
Okay.
So I had in my university office, I had four computers running servers. The university network, I think, was a maximum of 10 megabits per second at the time. That was and this was unheard of. And so a huge big sort of bandwidth and so on. But I'm sure a fair bit of that was taken up with my game servers, which I managed to explain as, well, I need them for the undergraduate degree in computer and video games. Yeah. So you better let me run them and so on. So I had four of these things. I think one was a Windows NT. One was a Linux machine, or two of them were Linux machines, and one was an old Silicon Graphics IRIX, Silicon Graphics Challenge S running IRIX, and so on. So I had all these game servers running on it. They were all first-person shooters. So I had people across America, all these gamers, America and Europe and so on, logging in to play these first-person shooters.
Right.
I think certainly first-person perspective games are very, very good. And the only other game that I really, really got into was Gran Turismo.
Mm.
Of course, first-person perspective in the driver's cockpit and so on. Very good sound effects of Gran Turismo.
So Quake, I guess Quake is, you have to call it 2D?
3D.
Is it 3D already?
Oh, yes.
The earliest Quake, though.
The earliest Quake. It was by ID Studios, or ID Studios, ID Studios, and they are famous for, what was the game called? Catacomb Abyss, if I remember correctly. And that was one of the very, very first three-dimensional games with the idea of perspective, but particularly it was the first game, if I remember correctly, with the hands, representing the hands of the player, holding a weapon or grabbing something, grabbing the enemy, if I remember correctly. And that very quickly developed into Wolfenstein.
Right,
3D, which is another one of their more famous games, and they carried on with that. And then it developed into Doom.
Yeah.
And Doom was certainly a first-person perspective, three-dimensional.
Right.
Of course, it's all visual trickery with perspective and vanishing points and so on. And then, of course, that evolved into the Quake series, Quake 1, Quake 2, and Quake 3 Arena, and Quake 4, and whatever. And Doom, of course, is always there in the background, coming back every so often.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't play games anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, the Quake, that is, you said it's 3D. I mean, the game, your perceived game world is 3D, but the presentation is, can you call it 3D?
It's first-person perspective.
Right.
You are placed as a player looking into the screen with the hands holding the game in front of you.
Yeah.
So you would call that three-dimensional.
Mm.
Yeah?
Okay.
It is, of course, on a flat two-dimensional screen. It's not like, say, virtual reality where you can actually physically almost walk into there and so on. You just have this view of the monitor and you can see the rest of your bedroom or whatever and so on.
Right.
It is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional space, you might say.
Yeah. I remember talking to a professor at a conference earlier this year, and then he said he was talking to some people from Sony, and then they say that Sony at first they weren't sure if they wanted to develop 3D games because they weren't sure if people are going to like 3D games. That specific thing just stuck in my mind because it's difficult to imagine these days now that people would prefer 2D over 3D games, but back then, because 3D wasn't a thing, it was even a question.
I guess so. Like I say, I haven't played games for many, many years and so on. But I think there's still a lot of two-dimensional games.
Of course.
Particularly if you think of your mobile phone these days. How many 2D games are there for that and so on?
Another thing is you mentioned that was the time when game study became a thing. And then it merged technical aspect and the critical theories and cultural studies. Where did you get your knowledge or your experience of from that side, from the cultural studies and critical theories? Have you taken any university courses or you just read?
I'm not sure I have any knowledge in it. Never taken any, never taken any courses in cultural studies specifically or critical theory specifically. But obviously, that kind of thing is right from my undergraduate days in music. Yeah, music history, for example, oh. Music composition, music analysis. It's all cultural studies. It's all critical theory, if you like,
right.
If not actually, while not actually being called that, particularly critical theory, I know is a specific area and so on, but it is through and through all of those courses.
Mm, yeah, right.
So yeah. It is there.
Yeah.
I've never trained in philosophy, for example, but I'm interested in philosophy. So you don't need to have been trained in these things to have an interest in there and recognize it in all your courses, all your studies. There are, or should be, certainly, many, many aspects of philosophy, cultural studies, history, critical theory, and so on there.
Mm,
yeah. Even if they're not specifically called that.
Yeah. That's encouraging because I'm doing human-computer interaction research. I come from a computer science background, but lately, well, for a while now, I have some strong interest in philosophy of technology specifically, and I wanted to bring perspectives from that field into HCI and then think more about why we do things and how we could do things better and et cetera.
More thinking, less doing. You might say.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's what you do moving up to a faculty position, you know, from studentship. Yeah. I guess you have been working on sound in games, but as time goes by, do people start to have more? Because back then you studied first person shooter games, Quake, and now you have, you know, many more things to study. And then do you think that do you see that field growing, and do you feel it's easy to catch up with, you know, all the new developments?
I would say that I don't really work in the area of games anymore.
Okay.
And I haven't for at least a decade. Every so often, because, like you say, I was one of the early people in that era, every so often I get asked to write a chapter or something or other,
mm-hmm.
or to edit a book and so on. But I really don't work in that area that much more.
Mm.
Like I say, every so often I get asked to do these things, and I have a chapter I got to write on immersion by the end of this year for a forthcoming book. And a few years back, I got asked to help out an editor for what then became the Oxford Handbook of Video Game Music and Sound,
right.
If I recall it correctly, and so on, which came out a couple of years ago. So I am still peripherally involved in games and game studies and so on, but more from an editing perspective and so on, rather than specifically researching.
Yes,
I think the early days of game studies and academic studies in games and so on has changed quite a bit.
Mm.
Of course, you would hope it has changed.
Mm.
So it brings in many other theories, many other philosophies. It's starting to look at, it's been looking at synthesizing knowledge across different fields and bringing it in. And of course, VR, with its comeback about a decade ago, is obviously merging with games and so on. There's still a lot more to be done there. There's obviously a lot to be done with artificial intelligence. Yeah, obviously is coming into the picture, what you can do there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because all these other technologies alongside are evolving at a very, very fast pace, and they all can be used, and they all have an impact upon computer games. Of course, computer games are developing, and this then means that you have new researchers from, say, AI and VR and so on, human-computer interfaces coming into this ever-growing field of computer game studies, maybe converging around it, you might actually say.
Mm.
So, of course, it keeps on developing,
yeah.
And it will.
So yeah, so after game, then you switch to sonic virtuality and sound studies. But what do you think was the thing that in game studies that made you curious about the idea of virtuality or sonic virtuality? Is it because of the perceived immersion or presence in the first-person video games, seeing the two virtual hands representing yourself in the perceived 3D space?
I think, as a sound guy, I just got pissed off, if I can say that, at the concentration on the visual in computer games.
Right.
And I thought there is a lot more to it than that. There is a lot more importance to sound than is given a credence for. Like I say, this Codemasters studio where they show me rooms full of people working on the programming, on the vision and so on, on the 3D modeling, and opened a door and there was one poor guy sitting there by himself doing the sound in this tiny little studio and so on. So that really annoyed me and made me realize that actually there's more here, I can contribute here and so on, but it's not just a matter of sound design. How do you do Foley design? How do you sort of record footsteps in snow when you have no snow, for example? You use a mixture of rice and flour and all that kind of stuff and so on. And it's a very specialized job and so on, but it's more than that. So what is the relationship between sound, for example, and the image? Yeah, let's not ignore image because we want to concentrate on sound. What is the relationship there? How do they work together multimodally? How does sound contribute, with or without image, to the player's immersion or feeling of presence within the game, particularly first-person perspective games, and particularly when, certainly in the early days before VR, all you had is a flat two-dimensional screen in front of you, but it is a sound that provides a stereo and later the surround sound among you that allows you to perceive things in the game world behind you, which you cannot see, but you can perceive. To me, I got to thinking that actually sound is far, far, far more important than many people give it credence for in computer games, and perhaps in terms of immersion and presence and the feeling of being embodied within this whole virtual world and so on, it is even more important than the visual. So clearly that then leads on to questions of, well, what actually is sound? If you're an acoustician, you think sound is a sound wave. You go to the American National Standards Institute or the International Standards Organization, I don't know, I-9000, 10000, 11001, whatever the standard is and so on, it'll tell you what sound is. And certainly in the ANSI documentation, it's in the acoustics handbook for ANSI documentation, sound is defined as a pressure wave in a medium. Very, very similar to, but a more fancy words, to the dictionary definition. In other words, a sound is a sound wave, a moving pressure wave in a medium, and so on. And this is why in your door, for example, you see the up and down, and so on. That's a sound wave moving through frequency and so on. But it also, the ANSI documentation, has another definition of sound, which is that sound is the sensation as a result of the moving pressure wave oscillation defined in definition A. So there's definition A, the moving pressure wave through a medium. Definition B, it's the auditory sensation caused by the moving pressure wave and so on. But and I think this is just ridiculous.
But the auditory sensation is also something that can be traced in like your neurological reactions or...
This is where I think you need to be very careful of words. Sensation, perception.
Yes. So I was going to say that I guess what you would agree with is neither the sound wave representation or sensation, but it is your perception or your perceived sound or the sound that's happening in your mind, right?
So. Strictly speaking, an acoustician who follows the acoustics handbook, the definition of sound in the ANSI or ISO documentation, for example, would say that the sound wave produces a sensation. So acoustic energy is transferred to mechanical energy, is then transferred to electrical energy in the inner ear, and that is where the acoustician's interest in sound stops.
And
so the sensation, you might say, is that transformation of different forms of energy to electrical energy. The perception, which is where a psychoacoustician comes in, neuroscientists, cognitive scientists and so on, is what actually happens in the brain where we are actually consciously aware of it.
Right.
So we are not consciously aware of the electrical signals, but we are consciously aware of the effect of the electrical signals. And then, of course, you get into, well, how do we understand that perception? How do we relate it to other perceptions? How do we put it all together in our image of the world? Image is the wrong word, sorry. Picture is the wrong word because that's all visual. How do we put it together in our concept of the world, our understanding of the world, our being in the world, and so on? This is more perception, and this is where psychoacousticians come in. They want to know how you feel when you hear that sound, where do you perceive a sound coming from, and so on. The philosophy of sound, and this is another chapter I've got to write at the end of this year, is very interesting. Yeah. The ancient Greeks, for example, believed that sound was a stream of particles, like buzzing bees, swarming bees, and so on. Yeah, and that has a very interesting parallel to quantum physics, where they now have the concept of a phonon, which is a vibrating particle of sound.
Okay.
But it's really since since von Helmholtz and others around about the 19th century, Lord Rayleigh or Raleigh and so on, in the 19th century and so on, that we come up with the idea of this pressure wave, of the concepts of frequencies and amplitude and so on. Helmholtz was very interested in the study of musical sounds. So his diagrams are very, very neat, and you have periodic waves. There's no noise in there and so on. But of course, our world of sound is incredibly noisy. There's very few pure sine waves through it.
Just pointing out that the amplitude, frequency, and realizing that these things are all these are all descriptions of sound that can be reproduced through some other medium. Like you put a needle, and then you can use it to draw the frequency.
And amplitude. It's that kind of understanding of what a sound wave is that allows, for example, people like Edison to come up with the concept of the phonograph in the late 1870s, and so on. The first recording and playback. There was recording of sound waves before, going back about 40 years, but no playback. So the first recording and playback of sound waves, around about the late 1870s, with people like Edison, the phonograph, and so on, are basically an analogue representation scratched into the early tin, the tin foil and so on, of the sound wave, which is this first definition in the ANSI handbook, standards handbook, of the moving pressure wave in a medium. And, of course, the idea that von Helmholtz was saying you can break down a complex sound wave, like my voice or piano sound, into constituent components of sine waves, starting with a fundamental frequency of the lowest sine wave, and decreasing in amplitude but increasing in frequency. And it's a combination of those, different combinations, that provides the different timbres. And so on. So if you can break down a complex sound wave, like my voice, into different components, you can see the connection then to things like fast Fourier transforms, which are this way of breaking down, and the whole digital audio. You can break things down into separate components and then do interesting things with those components and then resynthesize them.
Right, yeah. You've described the different definitions of sound that different people of different profession might refer to, right? You have the physical sort of description of it, and then you have the perceptual description of it, and then is there yet another layer of like a philosophical description of it or something? Because when you say perception, I think you were still describing perception as something that again can be traced in like your brain activity but then one may argue that is not all there is. You've written in some of your work that you could have sound perception with absence of sound, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm playing back in my mind a familiar song, is it triggering the same brain activity as I was hearing the song before, or is it something different?
Well, let's give 5 seconds to your listeners to spend first imagining the sound of a trumpet, and then, for example, the sound of, say, their mother's voice. I'm sure, in common with me, and hopefully in common with you, Trish, is that the listeners are able to imagine the sound and get a perception of the different timbres. Yeah? Even if they were the same frequency, timbre is defined as that characteristic of sound that distinguishes one sound from another sound, where those two sounds have the same frequency and same amplitude. If there's a difference, it's timbre. Yeah? So your mother's voice will sound very different in terms of timbre to a trumpet. Yeah? So, in other words, I'm sure you had no problem with my instruction to imagine the sounds, yeah? And you imagine them in your brain, in your mind, and so on. But the instruction to imagine a sound, you have no problem with it, when really, perhaps I should have been saying, imagine a perception of a trumpet or something. You imagine a sound. So in our everyday lives, a sound wave is not sound. It is the sound perception we have of that sound wave. And we can imagine a sound without the sound wave being there. There are other interesting philosophical conundrums here. If I were to ask you, what is that sound over there outside the window? You might answer it's a bird or it's a car. So in our everyday lives, we use the sound wave source, the bird, the car, to describe the sound. We do this quite naturally.
Yeah.
And then if you also think of metaphor and metonyms and synecdoches and similes and onomatopoeia and so on, all of these ways that we use sound and describe sound through some other modality, for example, sound is bright.
Yes.
Yeah, which is to do with light and so on.
Warm,
the sound is
cold.
Soft and warm and cold and so on. We are multimodal. None of this is ever discussed in the ANSI and ISO standards handbooks. Yeah, sound is a moving pressure wave through a medium, or sound is a sensation in an auditory system. Nothing about how sound works with vision, sound works with smell, sound works with touch, and so on. Nothing about how we understand a sound wave, yeah, as a perception, and marry that to our experience or our emotions, for example. None of that. And all of these things are things that we can just call like that to mind in our brain without there being a sound wave.
Right.
And I have many other objections to the standards, but maybe we'll get onto that later on.
Yeah, just following on this thread. So, if we could, we're all able to imagine a sound successfully in our mind, then is there still anything specific about sound or the acousticness of it? Like, I could imagine like an image that I've seen before. I could imagine a sensation that I had before, pain or whatever, right? But so what makes the recalled experience of sound?
The recalled experience of sound. Well, it all depends on definitions. Yeah, I disagree with the definition of sound in the standards handbooks, because for me that's actually a definition of a sound wave, and the second definition that they have, that it is an auditory sensation, that's an auditory sensation. The perception we have when we sense sound, or, as you were talking about, purely imagine, conjure up the perception and so on, that for me is sound. And it can have the sound wave as part of it, can be triggered by that. It can be triggered by tinnitus. If you look at the standards handbooks, particularly the ANSI one, the American National Standards Institute, it will specifically say tinnitus is not sound. And yet if anyone has tinnitus, either the sh variety or the me variety, they will absolutely tell you that they hear the sound. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you hear? If you go back to the ancient Greeks, yeah, what is the object of hearing? It is a sound. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So if you hear the effect of tinnitus, you were hearing a sound.
Mm.
And yet the acousticians would say that's not sound because there is no sound wave there.
Right.
Yeah? And yeah. only just beginning to get into Chinese philosophy of sounds and so on, but I'm sure you could fill me in quite a bit more on this and things like ch and so on, if I pronounce it correctly and so on. But this is a whole interesting area there. I can see many overlaps with the some of the Western, the ancient Western philosophy and so on, but also many areas of difference. Don't ask me about it, because I'm still reading and learning about it.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure if I'm an expert on that either. But just to push this further, so you just gave the audience a task of recalling a sound of some sort that they would have experienced before, right? To conjure up a sound that I haven't experienced before might be a bit more difficult than, let's say, imagine a visual scene that I haven't experienced. But it seems that I'm better at, so I could imagine like a deer walking in space or something, right? Which is something that I haven't seen. But sound seems more difficult.
Yeah. Okay. What is the sound of a T-Rex?
Then it would be the
pre-representation park, etc. No one's ever heard or experienced the sound of a T-Rex. There is a whole developing field of paleoacoustics, I think it's called, which looks at fossils, particularly where you have the neck and the mouth and the skull and so on, and say, okay, with this size and these dimensions to the vocal tract and the mouth, etc., we can have an educated guess that it would sound like this and so on. But before this developed, what is the sound of a T-Rex?
Yeah.
What is the sound of the alien in Ridley Scott's Alien? Yeah, it makes a sound. What is the sound of all the weird creatures in Star Wars and stuff like that? No one's ever heard these. We use our imagination. So what do? Yeah, we go to our deep past, if you like. What is a sound that will scare me? Yeah? Maybe it's a lion roaring. Yeah? Maybe it's the sound of a hyena laughing. Maybe it's this, that, and the other. And what happens if I put them all together and think about the size of a T-Rex? Yeah? Magnify it, increase the bass and so on. Make it sound organic, as if it's something that wants to come and grab me and eat me and so on. So we are perfectly capable of going back, if you like, into our prehistoric mind and say, this is a sound that will scare me, even if no one has ever even heard a lion, never even heard a trumpet and so on, a trumpeting elephant or something like that, or or laughing hyena and so on. You can think about that and put it together. There's a famous paper that won the Ig Nobel Prize in acoustics, yeah, which was called the Psychoacoustics of a Chilling Sound. I forget the name of the authors. I think it was from the 1990s, but I could be wrong about that. And what it was, and I'm going to ask you whether it has the right effect, you know what a blackboard is?
Yeah,
you're younger than me. Yeah? Younger than me, so I'd be very surprised you know what a blackboard is. But it's running your fingernails down the blackboard. Yeah, already the hairs are standing up on the back of my neck. You can possibly even see hairs standing up in my arms. Yeah, it's a very chilling, horrible sound and so on. So the authors here did a whole study of this. And they eventually came up with the idea, speculating and comparing to modern-day monkeys, that actually this is a, what do they call it, fight-or-flight response to when we were prehistoric men dancing about in the trees, or monkeys and so on, and apes and so on, prehistoric apes and so on. It is the similar sound to the screeching of a modern-day macaw, a warning sound, yeah? predators in the area, watch out, and so on. So when you get all this adrenaline flowing through you, the hairs on the back of your neck standing up, that's the fight or flight response and so on. So they came up with the idea that actually this particular sound is so similar to these modern day sound of the macaw that it is actually still in our lizard brain, if you like, and so on. It's still there as an early day memory that this is something, means something we should be frightened of. So I think the very best sound designers thinking, what is the sound of a T-Rex? What is the sound of an alien creature and so on? They will pull this up from their early brain. They imagine, what are these sounds? Of course, film sound designers have almost 100 years worth of previous experiments in this to call on and improve and work with.
When you say that, I remember that. I don't know if you've ever played or seen the game Left 4 Dead. It's a game
I used to play a lot of.
And then you know there is a type of zombies called the witch or something, right? So when you see that, you've started the witch, and then it's a very high
sequence. You're queuing me up very well. Yeah, I have actually written about that witch sound in a couple of publications and so on. I'm sure everyone either knows it or forgive me for the spoiler, but it's the sound of a crying baby. The witch sound. And of course, particularly if you're a young male and you're playing Left 4 Dead, you are the hero riding in to save the crying baby, the poor little thing. Of course, it needs saving and so on. And this is a wonderful sound effect, I think, that gets into the area of ambiguity because it calls you in. You go off and hunt. Where's that sound of that poor little crying baby? Mark, the great hero, has to go in and save it. And then, bang, it gets you. It's actually a witch luring you in. It's a very clever sound effect, I think.
Yeah. And then the high frequency of the screaming after you startled it is one of the few most scary things about that game.
And of course the witch's claws slashing you as you lie on the ground.
And then that just reminded me of another clever use of sound for like horror effects. Have you watched Twin Peaks? Twin Peaks, the TV series.
This is going back a long time. I've watched some of the episodes.
Right.
Yeah.
And then one of the famously scary things is the girl Laura Palmer's scream, and then the director will put in like a very zoomed in shot on her face, and then with a very exaggerated facial expression of screaming, and then the scream is like very high frequency disturbing sound.
It's very good. David Lynch, who's a director, is I think he's still alive, or did he just die recently?
He just died recently.
He died recently, yes. He was very famous for his attention to sound. If you look at things like a Razorhead, for example, very clever use of sound, and his Dune film and so on, very, very clever. Yeah, he did an early film version of Dune with the same actor Twin Peaks. His name? Carl McLachlan?
Yes, the failed sort of version.
I think it's the best version. Actually, it's very, very.
He was not. He was very unhappy about it because he lost the editing rights,
But any film with Sting in has to be good.
Okay.
He's okay.
So we were talking about sound, the different sensations, the different representation of it, different definition of it. You said that you studied sound in games at first, and then the lack of attention on sound, I guess, was one of the motivation for you to study sound specifically outside of the game context. And then naturally we talk about sound today in like virtual reality, virtual or computer generated sound for immersion or presence. These thinking also extend to real life, right? As our perception of sound. Your focus today, would you say that is more about just sound in general, or is it still about computer-created sound?
It is very much sound in general. The other thing I object to about the ANSI definitions of what sound is and so on is that it will define sound, or the sound wave, as strictly speaking is, particularly in terms of the second definition, where sound is the auditory sensation produced by the moving pressure wave, as between 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else is not sound. It is infrasound, it is ultrasound, and so on. So this got me thinking that actually this is really quite absurd. And I started getting interested in ultrasound about 4 or 5 years ago when I was in Denmark at Aalborg University. And I realized that there are not many people researching ultrasound in the environment. And there's an increasing use of, or an increasing production by humans of ultrasound for all sorts of equipment, whether it's for emulsifying paint, whether it's for finding faults in tubing, whether it is for medical ultrasound, for example, destroying kidney stones, blowing out kidney stones, or scanning fetus in the body.
Mm.
There's all sorts of uses for ultrasound, sensors for automatic doors, etc., etc., safety, fail-safe devices for fire alarms in buildings and so on. They're all using ultrasound, so there's an increasing emission of anthropogenic, by which I mean human-produced, ultrasound into our own environments, but also into the wider ecology of the world and so on. And like anything humans produces, it can be defined as a form of pollution.
Mm.
But no one is really studying it. There is some study in the oceans where ships use ultrasound sensors, ultrasound emitters, to ensure that sea creatures do not attach themselves to the ship's hulls and therefore travel around the world and therefore destroy the local marine environments and so on. There's some studies there that show that they actually physically damage things like porpoises and dolphins and killer whales and so on, in addition to interfering with their uses of ultrasound for echolocation, communication and so on. And of course, ship's propellers produce a lot of infrasound, human audible sound, and a wide range of ultrasound above that.
Right.
We have a huge sonic effect on the oceans and so on. So I became interested in ultrasound because of this, because I thought, well, what about other hearing, other creatures?
Hmm.
I was really interested from the point of view initially of making fun of the ANSI acoustics definitions of what sound is, saying, look, isn't it ridiculous that a bat, for example, it's got ears like us, it's got a similar auditory system to us, it's got an outer ear, it's got pinner, the flappy bit of things that we can see in our ears and so on, it's got the middle ear, it's got the inner ear, it's got the brain to perceive all these sound wave and the sound sensation and so on. How can you not call that sound? Yeah. How can you define it as something different? And then why is it that we use cats very often to study human hearing? Cats, of course, there certainly used to be no ethical implications in sort of sticking things into their brains and cutting one side of the auditory nerve and leaving the other ear fine and so on, and therefore sort of inferring something about human hearing. But cats hear all the way up to around about 80 kilohertz, which is 60 kilohertz higher than what humans hear. Mm. So my thinking was, how can you not call this sound? And how can you only call the objects of hearing sound if it's human audible sound? So I got into it because of that. And then I began to realize, well, actually, there's a huge amount of ultrasound that is output by us.
Mm, right.
All your electric toothbrushes.
Mm.
I am very careful about how long I leave those in my mouth, because it's right in your skull, right next to your auditory system and so on. And there's very high pressure ultrasound that comes from that. Yeah?
Mm.
So I'd be very careful about how long you use an electric toothbrush for. They're actually,
do you use
it? Probably better than a manual one. I do use it, yeah, but I take it out ever so often, then put it back in and so on. There's an awful lot
going
on. So I'm interested in the ultrasound. And then, of course, this leads into, well, what is it actually like to be able to perceive as a bat?
That comes with a famous paper.
Fruit-eating bats, insectivorous bats, the ones that use ultrasound for echolocation, hunting bats, hunting grasshoppers, mosquitoes flying around and so on, using this, they will obviously have a different perception of the world that is a lot more spatially founded on their use of ultrasound than their visual acuity. Yeah. Many of these bats are pretty much blind anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do they need sight when they're flying about at night? And their bats, their bat caves, for example, if they're in caves, are completely pitch black. Why do they need sight? They only need sound. So what is it like to perceive the world as a bat? And this is a famous essay from 1974, I think, by Thomas Nagel, entitled, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And it's all about this question, how can we actually, as humans, understand what it is like to be a bat when we simply do neither sense nor perceive like a bat? If you extrapolate that, if you think about human beings' disastrous effect on the planet, surely if we are to ameliorate and lessen and roll back that effect on the planet, it would also help to have some understanding about other creatures, A, how they perceive the world with their very different sensory abilities, but B, how they respond to all this pollution we are foisting on the world, which is not just visual pollution, light pollution at night. It's not only gas pollution, CO2, CO, methane, etc., 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 but it is also sound pollution, where sound I define very broadly, all the way from infrasound through to ultrasound.
And then I guess your mentioning of the paper, What It Feels Like to Be a Bat, obviously connects to your thinking about AI, is that the specific case of humans imagining how a bat perceived sound, the impossibility of it, phenomenologically speaking, is a key for understanding the impossibility of comparing a human being to an AI. Right.
Yes, or comparing any creature to an AI, I would say.
Yeah.
What do humans sense? We can touch within our arm's length distance, if you like. We can touch. Yeah. We have certain sensations of whether something is smooth, whether something is rough, and so on. We can sense heat, hot and cold, and so on. We can sense electromagnetic waveforms between particular, I think it's nanometer wavelengths, and this is light for us. Yeah? We can hear in terms of 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, a lot less if you're older, up at the very top and so on, or have hearing damage and so on. We can smell. Famously, our sense of smell is not that much, is not that good, and so on. We can taste. Yeah, smell and taste, maybe they're very similar in many ways and so on, and so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But all of these different sensations have different thresholds. Yeah, so other creatures have different thresholds. I've already mentioned that many creatures, and there is increasing evidence that some plants, are able to sense ultrasound, which is above the threshold of human hearing. Many creatures can sense things like ultraviolet, infrared. Many creatures use can sense magnetism. Birds navigating around the world follow the magnetic fields. Yeah, some of them. And so on. So all of these other creatures have very different senses to us, sensory capabilities, and this means they must have very different understandings of their world. Now, think about an AI. Yeah? All of these creatures evolved through millions of years to make use of their sensory capabilities, in many cases fine-tune their sensory capabilities to produce a very focused, what von Uxkill would call Umwelt, their own little world picture, if you like, through which they are able to be highly effective.
Yeah.
They evolved all this through millions of years. An AI has been cobbled together by humans in a few years, if you like, and so on. It has very little sensory capability, and even that I would question whether you could call it sensation. It has absolutely no perceptual ability, and of course we're talking about large language models and so on, its store of knowledge comes not from its own experience, because it has no experience, it cannot have experience, because it has no way to perceive and sense. It all comes from human experience, uploaded. Google, Anthropic, OpenAI, etc., etc., trawling the web. Yeah, I don't want to say stealing, but I currently have a class action case against Anthropic for what they've been doing and so on. But trawling the web, taking in all this human knowledge in text-based form. Yeah, the vast majority is text-based form.
Yes.
So in other words, when it comes to hearing, when it comes to seeing, when it comes to touch, smell, taste, it's all text-based descriptions of what those very human experiences are that an AI simply cannot have. An AI has no way to sense, no way to perceive. It has no conscious, no subjective experience of self, which is what Thomas Nagel, in his article, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, would define as consciousness.
Yes. Yes, I think we can agree that an AI would have no conscious experience or subject or anything like that, and also no sensory experience. Nice transition to your latest work on what it feels like to be an AI. And then I guess what that, I just keep thinking about the question I asked before, like if you try to conjure up a sound in your mind, and obviously I would use my other sensory experience as well. I can imagine a bright sound. I can imagine a warm or dark sound. So in a way, it's similar to using textual descriptions. So when I'm thinking a warm sound, I can imagine the word warm. I'm imagining the sound. So could it be possible that for an AI or a large language model, even though it would not have experienced any sound, but just by reading all the textual descriptions of sound experiences online, in books, over many centuries of accumulated knowledge, can have a relatively accurate representation of what sound experience would be like?
That is a very interesting question. I have one of my PhDs, Wu Wenqi, who has just started, who wants to come up with a system where a human being can describe the sound that they want the AI to produce in terms of an audio file by using things like metaphor and cross-modality, warm, cold, smooth, sharp, etc., etc., etc. He wants to come up with a system. And obviously the issue is the AI being able to understand what a metaphor is. Of course, when you ask AI what is a metaphor, it'll tell you. But will it actually understand in having that experience of what a metaphor is? Yeah. So if I say, for example, the sound of your voice is very warm, yeah? I have that from my experience comparison to loads of other sounds where I would say describe the sound as harsh or rough or cold or violent, etc., etc., warm. We have an innate cultural understanding of what warm is through reading a whole lot of books, through listening to sounds, experiencing sounds, taking pleasure in sound, being scared of sounds in particular environments, putting it together with other modalities like smell and taste and vision, especially, that a AI simply does not have. So if an AI only has the descriptions in all the text that it scrapes of the sound is warm, what is the context it has to understand that and therefore be able to synthesize you a warm sound? And of course, subjectivity is exactly that. It is individual to the individual subject.
What
I think is a warm sound
exactly
is someone else's cold sound. Yeah, the old English saying, one man's meat is another man's poison. And so on. So what is the AI? The other thing that worries me about AI, of course, is that these vast bodies of knowledge, textual, mainly textual-based knowledge and so on, they are statistically the results you get back from AI is statistically inferred. Mm. In other words, it's tending towards the bell curve, the center of the bell curve all the time. So this is why you end up with AI slop. Mm. Yeah, you will not actually have any creativity in terms of human creativity as we understand it from an AI. And when you ask for a warm sound, if I ask you to design a warm sound yourself, it's going to be very different to the warm sound that I design. There will be some commonality to it.
Yes.
But eventually you get to the point where if you ask AI to design a warm sound, Claude will design it like that, Gemini will design it like that, Copilot will design it like that or whatever, and they'll actually be so similar. They will be so similar.
Mm. Yeah, just to give an audience an idea of the difference in perceived qualities of sound, there is always the I guess running joke of the hi-fi enthusiasts circle that they all they think they all know what does it mean to have a sweet tweeter and then to have a warm bass or something, but when you put them to blind test, they could never agree on what is warm.
Exactly.
And
yet these are the terms we communicate in, and these are the terms that we think we have a shared understanding of what a sweet sound is, what a warm sound is, what a fat bass is.
Yeah.
Maybe they're completely different. Yeah.
Yes, and I'm thinking that since sound is, whenever we talk about sound, whenever we talk about something that we have seen or we are looking at, that we can just point at it, or I can say, I remember the famous painting by Van Gogh or whatever, and then we have this image in our mind, and then I can safely assume that the image that you've seen is pretty much the same as the one I've seen. But with sound, unless we are listening to this sound at the same time, it's difficult to say that the sound you listened to is exactly the same as my experience, because it could be affected by like noise or by your state of mind. I don't know if I'm making sense, but
yes,
what I'm trying to say is that whenever you're talking about sound, you have to use more analogies or metaphors than you were talking about a visual experience or something.
Fingers on a blackboard. Are the hairs standing up on the back of your neck? Yeah? You can understand that because you know what the sound of fingers on a blackboard is like. Maybe some of your listeners don't understand that. Others will, and so on. So some of your listeners might think, well, that's weird. What on earth's wrong with fingers on a blackboard? What would that sound like? It's actually fingernails on a blackboard, I should say, and so on. But those who have the shared experience will imagine more or less the same sound. Their hairs on the back of their neck will be standing up and so on. In exactly the same way as those who have seen a picture, one of the many pictures I think that Van Gogh painted of sunflowers, will have a understanding, some sort of yellow, large flower heads usually coming out of a vase, and they're the sole sort of object of attention within the picture frame and so on. But it won't be exactly the same. Not at all. It cannot possibly be.
Right. I mean, maybe what I'm saying is, I guess in the visual image, or in the visual perception, there is more perceived information than in sound. At least it's the information.
More perceived information.
Yes. it would be something like that you can consciously reflect on using your reasoning capabilities, which sounds like describing an AI. But yeah, those things you can make sense of, the color and the different the spatial properties, different partitions of the image and whatever. But with sound, you could say that it's difficult to compare exactly the amount of information in visual or acoustic experience. But in sound, at least, there is more that you cannot describe than in vision. No. So, you have a limited
You're
set
clearly
of
biased towards image, aren't you? Whereas I'm biased towards sound. I would disagree with you because I think it all depends what are the characteristics of sound, how you might describe it, and how far you can go in defining every last iota of the image or every last iota of the sound. Now, in terms of our recall of an image, or auditory imagery, shall we say, visual imagery, auditory imagery, in terms of our recall of that, how detailed do you want to be? Yeah?
Mm.
When you mentioned Van Gogh's sunflowers, I have a extremely vague extremely vague in terms of the colour, in terms of the texture, in terms of the size, in terms of how many flowers there are, etc. there, but it is enough for me to picture in my mind's eye one of Van Gogh's sunflowers. And it's the same with what is the sound of a lion roaring, for example. Yeah, can you picture the sound of a lion roaring?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the MGM lion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You will have more or less the same auditory image in your mind as I will have. And it's, if you think about it, it's actually quite detailed.
Mm.
Maybe you will also have a visual image to go with it. I mentioned the MGM lion at the beginning of MGM films. You probably got it. I think his name was Leo.
Right. So, yeah. Or maybe I should say this. So in describing sound, let's, if we describe a visual experience in our conversation, then there's always a lot more to describe it with. Like I could, like, you know, point. I could mark that I've seen something this big, right? I've seen something of a certain color, of a certain shape, and I could do a lot to reproduce. I could draw it up. I could, you know, gesture, but with sound. It's like I could try my best to reproduce the sound of Leo the lion, but that's pretty much the only way I could do it. But it's also very limited way, because it's always difficult.
I could describe it as an organic sound. So clearly from a living creature, it is that complexity. For example, it is not a periodic sound. It is a highly inharmonic sound, more akin to noise. It has no pitch, but there is certainly a change in the frequency that we can perceive. It is a very low sound. It starts as a low sound and then it gets larger. It's almost a quite sort of tactilely rough sound. It's a sort of a, as if you're scratching fingernails along a very sort of rough foam, polystyrene foam. That sort of, you can feel that sort of going on there. And it lasts about sort of 3-4 seconds, etc., etc. And it sounds like something that's going to eat me.
Right.
Was that a longer description than your previous description of the sunflowers?
But,
and I've hardly even got into the detail.
Yes, yeah. But you don't have to, because for anyone who is not a sound study person, they probably never spent such a long time describing a sound.
What a shame. What a shame.
Yeah. Yeah. But
start thinking about sound, listeners out there.
Yeah. But linking this back to your approach of discussing what it feels like to be an AI, and then using the bat and the perception of sound, I guess, as an entry point. These days, we always tell our students, first of all, we all know that everybody is using AI to do their work. Even the PhD students, they're using it to write papers, to brainstorm and to whatever. And then at least at the beginning, I always tell them not to use it because it takes away your chance of learning. But they would use it anyway. I've just always been thinking about what's the best way to illustrate the limitations of using AI, the limitations of the capability
of AI. For doing student work.
For doing anything, for thinking, for creative tasks mostly.
Yeah, it's what I mentioned before. If we're talking about large language models that most students will be using, and programs like Suno, for example, mm-hmm. that produce music and so on. The issue is what I mentioned before, this statistical inferral of what is the most likely answer, if you like, to a given question or a given prompt and so on, from this large mass of very, very generalized human knowledge, what Alex Beer, my co-author, and I are calling a received phenomenology, which is akin to the idea of received wisdom. You get a wisdom from someone else, but it's not actually your own wisdom. So received phenomenology that you have in these LLM databases and so on are then sort of plucked out, the most obvious, the most generalized, etc., etc., comes out. And then the question there is that when it comes out, it ends up on Google Docs or it ends up on some journal database for download. It's again then scraped up off the floor by the AI again and fed back in. So this is why I say it just sort of tends towards the peak of the bell curve. Mm. So this is the real problem, I think, with AI in these applications, whether it's music composition, whether it's student paper composition or thesis composition and so on. It is this sort of averaging out, this generalization, this loss of spark, that human creativity we have. That is a real danger of this type of AI.
Mm.
And all of this without any experience.
Yeah.
All of this without any understanding of what it's actually doing and the effect it has.
Yeah.
Even morals. Does AI have morals? Good, bad?
Yeah, I think we can all agree on the overall impact of AI on creativity or the society. I think, but just to for the very simple task of illustrating to the students the limitations of an AI's capability to create really unique, creative, valuable work for them, hopefully might, you know, make them think twice before just asking AI to write a paper for me.
Yeah, you're quite right. You don't learn anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't improve yourself, whether your skills, your knowledge, and so on, if you're using AI.
But that, I think, is not enough.
Not enough.
So again, when I was talking about the example of sound, and then how I think that, but whenever we describe sound, we usually need to rely a lot on other modalities, like so for example, when you were mentioning the imagine the line raw of the MGM mm-hmm. line, and then I immediately associate with the image, right? But when you ask me to imagine an image, it may not always be associated with sound. So I don't know if this special quality of sound doesn't make it easier or more difficult to work with sound in AI. The Suno generated songs in AI, they tend to converge in quality or in typically very, as you said, peak of the bell curve.
Multiple questions there, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah. I will finish the question about the advice to the student and so on. The thing is, when you have this statistically inferred answer given back to you, your paper is written from this massive sort of a generalized knowledge that is simply a vicious circle, is the previous sort of AI slot that is spewed out is then taken back into this knowledge and then added into the generalized knowledge from which you then statistically infer the next paper and so on. Everything is going to tend towards that middle center point and so on. So if you as a student wish to make your mark on the world, rise above the AI slop, you have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
And in the end, it is to your benefit to do it yourself, because you're also learning. It allows you to pull yourself above the rest of your colleagues, the rest of the world who are using AI, and to make a difference for yourself, to pull yourself out. So that's that. That's the advice I would give. And of course, you would make your lecturer very happy. Yeah, realizing that he's actually reading something produced by a human being instead of AI and so on. There's nothing worse than feeling that I'm being paid to mark the output of an AI instead of the output of a student.
Mm.
Yeah, we all want to educate. We all want to see students improve and so on. And we don't get that with AI-produced slop. You mentioned that, or you asked, that if you see an image, do you also imagine a sound? The answer to that is yes. There have been quite a few interesting studies done with showing film to subjects while scanning their brain, particularly the auditory cortex, to see if there's any activity. And you show a film with the sound, you can see the auditory activity. To different subjects, you show you just play the sound, you get specific patterns of auditory activity. You then play the film without any audio, and lo and behold, you get the same or very similar pattern of auditory of activity in the auditory cortex. This means the brain is imagining the sound that goes with the image.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not always the case that when you imagine a sound, you will see an image.
Right. Yeah.
Likewise, it's not always a case of when you see an image, you will imagine the sound. Yeah, or even if you imagine an image, you will imagine the sound, and vice versa. But the two very often do go hand in hand.
Yeah, I think in talking about this, what I'm really thinking is just whether the example of sound is a good example to show the students that because of the difficulty of describing sound in textual form, the AI-generated sound, they all tend to be very like average in quality, like comparing to AI-generated visual materials.
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess there is something to the argument that human beings are primarily visual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the belief of the majority, I think.
That, I think, is what the majority believe. It's rather strange because if you believe in evolution, if we really did descend from pre-apes, pre-monkeys and so on, that lived in jungle-like environments and so on. If you think in a jungle,
right,
you have a very limited visual horizon.
Mm.
It's much better to be able to hear. You can hear further than you can see.
Mm.
Yeah. So you need warning that there is some predator coming towards you, or you need warning that there's some juicy prey over there and so on. So it's quite possible that actually originally we were very much hearing, predominantly hearing species and seeing. And it's when we descended from the trees and began to walk upright and moved out of the forests and jungles, we had to stand upright to be able to see over the tops of grass and so on. That's when we became visual. That is one theory I have heard. And clearly we're talking about going back hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years in evolution and so on. I think.
Yeah,
as a sound guy, what a shame. What a shame. Yeah.
Speaking now of evolution, and as I'm interested in philosophy of technology, and some of the notable philosophers such as Stigler looks like evolution and how technology or technicity plays an important part of it. And then I'm going to throw you a random question. Is sound or vision more technical than the other?
Being a more visual species, we clearly tend to work on the visual side in terms of technology more than the hearing side in terms of technology. Yeah, the first evidences we have of anything that you might call creative or artistic are visual, on cave walls and so on. Really, there's nothing, the earliest musical instrument possibly goes back, there's some argument about this, about 40,000 years. Cave paintings go back a lot further than that. There are no recordings, absolutely no recordings, until about 150 years ago, 140 years ago, really. Yeah?
Right. Yeah.
No recordings. But you have photographs going back to, what, the 1820s, 1830s, the daguerreotypes and so on. You obviously have paintings where you can record people and so on. So this whole visual reproduction technology goes back thousands of years, tens, if you want to go back to cave art, hundreds of thousands of years before audio reproduction technology. So in that sense, you could say image, vision, is more open to technological adaptation, technological exploitation than hearing and sound has been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking maybe it's also possible that because the visual tools or instruments, they tend to leave marks or cave paintings, so then we know that we can say for sure that back then there was already a visual representation of things. But maybe there were also tools to create acoustic effects, but because they didn't leave any trace, so we would simply wouldn't know that maybe the, you know, the early Flintstones or whatever people are also using to make sound, but we would never.
Yeah. Yeah. There, around the world, there are all sorts of interesting stones with interesting depressions on them and interesting sounds that are made if you hit them with smaller stones, sounds that carry long distances. So there are theories that these were what you might call sounding stones, like a sort of drums, modern-day drums that you can use to carry over long distances, or like the trumpeting of elephants, or the sounds of blue whales, for example, travel thousands of kilometers and so on. There are those theories, and who knows, with the ancient sort of piece of clearly early human-made chimp flint chipped rock or whatever that you pick off of the cave floor, was it just an offcut, or was it something that was banged around the campfire? Who knows?
Yes.
There's an interesting theory. And again, if you go back to acoustics, if you decrease, as a sound wave travels through the medium and attenuates, it loses energy as it travels through the air. It never actually theoretically reaches zero energy.
Right.
Yeah? And of course, a sound wave travelling through air at room temperature of 20 degrees centigrade at sea level and blah, 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 is travelling at round about 341 metres per second. Yeah?
So
if you think about that, all the sounds that have ever been, all the sound waves that have ever been, are still there. We just lack the instruments to sense them.
Even in this recording room of a sound.
Even in this recording room. Yeah, we've been going on for hours and hours and hours and so on. It's still there.
Yeah,
it's still there.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about.
Theoretically.
Yeah.
We're inventing more and more sensitive equipment every year, so we are able to sense quieter and quieter and quieter sounds and so on as they die away. Yeah.
And that leads to my next question. So I guess we just described in one aspect of the complexity of reality that is larger than what we can perceive. We in computer or computational media, as we work in, we talk about virtual a lot. The virtualness, virtual reality, as the computer created. So the Chinese word "虚拟" is a conjured up word. It didn't exist in like ancient text or whatever, right? So it just came from the English word. So the VIR thing, I think in ancient Greek or something, means man, male, right? So and then that turned into something like virtue, which is like good qualities or possibilities of happening or something like that. And then in
potential.
Yeah, and then in like, I think in medieval Latin or something, it turned to something like potential. And then the potential, and then the positive aspect of potential of something that's, for example, these days we still say that something is virtually impossible, right? That means that, like, it's pretty much
almost
impossible. Yes,
so
almost.
Close. Yeah. So close to being possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then somehow that not yet realizedness became picked up by the description of computer-generated stuff, right? Virtual reality. So I just found that interesting, that in English you could, or in the English language, you could trace it back for, and you can see how it developed, but in Chinese there is no, there must be related concepts, but it just so happens we chose this very arbitrary description of virtual in describing computer generated experiences.
Yeah, I mean, Deleuze is a philosopher who really gets into the virtual.
Yeah.
Completely divorced from anything to do with computing. Masumi is another one and so on. But it is interesting. I personally hate the term reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I absolutely blame computer scientists for all these very weak uses of reality and mixed and extended and expanded and virtual and so on, all applied to reality and so on.
Reality is, you don't think about reality unless there is a non-reality, right? There's virtualness. You're starting to think about virtual things that don't exist, and then you start to think about reality that comes sort of a secondary.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think we have different concepts of what reality is. For me, reality is whatever I have in my brain right now, which is a very different reality to yours. We will share some reality because we are in the same room. We are presumably sent to the same temperature from this air conditioning, etc., etc., etc. We have some shared reality, but there is no such thing as a reality out there.
Mm-hmm.
Reality is in there, in our brains and our minds and so on. And which, what is out there, I call externality. It's just potential.
Right.
And here we get back to potential again, and so on. It's just a mass of energy, some of which we can sense naturally through our sensing systems of our body, within our thresholds and within our particular sensory abilities and so on, some of which other creatures sense in a very different way and so on, and some of which we, because we are now reasonably technologically adept, we can sense through technologies like ultrasound microphones, gamma ray detectors, etc., etc., etc. We're now able to detect this. So we don't know what reality is. If you're still one of those people who believe that reality is actually out there to be discovered, we've no idea really what it is. And it's with technology that we're beginning to discover a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and so on. But I'm one of those people who think there's no such thing as reality. Mm. Reality is a construct, if you like, in our brains. We have some sharedness about that and so on. But what's out there is just energy.
Yeah, exactly. That was what I meant.
Although, of course, how could I possibly know that?
Yeah, because when we were describing this concept, and then at some point we mentioned the animals, they are behaving for survival according to reality. But then, you know, they wouldn't think about reality. They wouldn't, the concept of reality wouldn't be in their consciousness because there's nothing to oppose it to, or virtuality, or they just behave and react based on like their perceived, their subjectives or whatever.
You've never seen a dog dreaming?
Yeah, they definitely do.
Isn't that a form of virtual reality? And sometimes they wake up and it's like that, and they're barking and ready to sort of... I've even been bitten by a dog who was woken up from a dream and so on. So that you can say from that sense that there is actually a mix between, let's say, the real world, and there's another term I hate, sort of between the real world and what's actually going on in a dog's mind.
Yeah.
Exactly. And again, to go back to what is it like to be a bat, or what is it like to be an AI, how do we know? We are extremely anthropocentric in saying a dog doesn't have this, and a dog has that, a dog behaves like this, and so on. How do we know?
That, again, is based on the assumption that there is an objective reality that is shared by all creatures.
Yeah.
But I think now we both think, at least now, that it's pretty much a human construct.
Yeah.
So then, as you mentioned...
Useful for computer scientists. Yeah.
Well, useful or is it really good or bad? As you said, we talk about extended. I primarily actually in HCI work in extended reality research, but people don't tend to think about the naming as much. That you have extended reality, augmented reality, virtual reality, but as
mixed reality,
yeah. But
you mix realities?
Yes. As I've become interested in the concept of, it was computer scientist Mark Weiser, he's a pioneer in ubiquitous computing. He basically, I think, conceptually started the field, and he has a seminal paper called The Computer of the 21st Century. And when, I think it was in the 80s or 90s, I forgot, but when he was writing that paper, virtual reality was just becoming a thing. And then he criticized virtual reality for... its effort in locking people in this closed simulated world, and he argued that we should my interpretation of what he said is that we should bring computer generated digital virtuality or whatever bring it into the physical world more than the other way around. Mm-hmm. And then so he coined a term, embodied virtuality, as an antithesis to virtual reality. And then I thought that's interesting because now these days we all, for people who do extended reality research, we would first assume that there is a reality, and then we think of different ways of augmenting it or mixing it, like I said. Maybe the focus should be instead on making virtuality more embodied instead of making reality more virtual. Because virtuality here, I think, loosely defined all the computer-created capabilities or experiences. And then by making that embodied, we wire those perceptions of these capabilities more naturally into our daily readiness of using them, right? So then is like making the capabilities of computing, blending it more naturally into our daily life, which is what embodied virtuality was advocating for, other than making us giving reality more and more in to computers.
I think, I don't know much about ubiquitous computing, but I think what you're talking about is what Don Eide would call embodied technics. He wrote a short book on that, which is an interesting read, which he developed from his post-phenomenology and so on. This embedding of technology into humans. It's an interesting idea, and clearly, in some cases, we're already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've embedded heart pacemakers, for example,
yeah.
and all yeah. sorts of things, medical devices into our bodies and so on. And then we now have artists such as Stellark and so on, and that guy with the bulb out of his head and so on, doing this for a couple of decades or so and so on. So people are starting to do this, embedding computer chips into them and so on. But I do wonder, really, what the point is, what are the dangers of it? Because again, our brain, our minds have evolved tens, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years and so on to deal with our bodies as they are. Yeah? This is how we make sense of the world. I think it's very interesting that you can embed some chip into that might give you the ultrasound echo location, mm-hmm. spatializing abilities of an insectivorous bat, and then it would be very interesting to see what that does to your mind and what that does to your embodiment in the world, embodiment and externality and so on. I think it's very interesting and so on, but I think it is far too early days to really say what the result of that might be. Maybe this is the real way that artificial intelligence should be going.
Right. But just on that, I think my understanding of embodied virtuality is not literally implanting something in your body. I think, mm-hmm. for example, brain computer interface is an extreme version of implanting something in your body,
yeah.
and I think that is a very lazy idea of for people who just purely lack imagination. They could only imagine that it's possible to wire your brain to a computer and then control it.
Yeah.
So we don't even need to talk about whether it's possible or not. Through careful design of interactive technology, we have more ways of making technology or virtuality more embodied in people's perception or subjective experience without actually putting something on your body.
Yeah.
But because that is something that is that doesn't sound as exciting as brain computer interface, so people tend not to care about it as much, or it doesn't acquire as much attention. Because I work in human computer interaction, and I think this particular research field does have its value, but it's just not as exciting as,
yeah.
you know. This idea of embodied virtuality is just something that I picked up again recently, and I think that's an interesting lens to provoke people to think more about the opposite direction of what we're doing with technology in extended reality, and try to think more meaningful ways of making computing technology work for people in better ways. Humans are already very technical beings, right? So some would say that the reason why we stand up on two legs and then we freed our hand is because we needed more tools. So in a way, that technology is a driving force of technology is part of us. It shaped how we became who we are today. So then computing technology is just a more, I guess, capable or substantial technology. And then AI may be something that amplified the efficiency of human use of computing further. So for one example of what I've been babbling about is attention. For example, now these days we're all using our phones, like we doom scroll, right? That's a word.
Mm-hmm.
And then because people working on extended reality devices, like Apple Vision Pro, for example, they are advocating that this might be the next generation of personal computing device, maybe after the form factor of it gets small and comfortable enough. So then the question is that in that future, if you're putting a screen in your face most of the time during the day, are you going to be more distracted by the, you know, computer interfaces or less because it's more embodied in a way that you're more conscious that it is in your face, and then you would be tempted to take more ownership of technology?
I think it's an interesting question. I don't know. I think people should get their faces out of their screens. Sitting in my terrace in my apartment here, the number of times I've seen people fall down walking along the street or cycling along the street, looking at their mobile phones, or they crash into something, or they trip over something, or whatever, and so on, it becomes quite amusing.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and that's because you have to hold the screen, external screen in your hand and pay extra attention to it.
They are so locked into their screens and so on. So, yeah, I can understand that. If you're asking whether that's a good thing and so on, I don't think so.
Mm.
I don't think so. And again, let's not forget a screen, mainly, it's visual.
Mm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It has a bit of audio in it, if you're hooked in with your earphones and so on. It has no smell, it has no touch, it has no taste or anything like that. I think we are, it's almost as if human beings have reached the point with our technology that we are in danger of reaching the vanishing point.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, what I'm saying about the glasses versus phones is that the claim the ubiquitous computing vision that Mark Weiser described with embodied virtuality, the criteria for him to evaluate these computing technologies is its disappearance. Right? He says the more diminished the computing is in our daily environment, the more useful it is. Mm. And I think for the form factor of a headset, XR glasses on your face, it also practically disappears. Right? You see through it. It would first solve the problem of having to look down on your phone most of the time.
Yeah.
And also, you don't have a specific physical device that demands your attention, but you have the risk of software interface popping up every now and then that distract you. So I don't know. It's just a future that I think at first it seems that it will be more. You always have these dystopian videos that describing this having certain, but that's what people think of instinctively. But I'm not sure if I'm hoping that with that type of technology, people would start to become more conscious of the screen on their face, and then they would be more careful of what they are forced to see or not.
Maybe. I'm hoping that I'll be long dead.
Yeah. I think that the vision of
I imagine that if you actually have that situation where your screen, your glasses in front of you, for a start, you're having to wear glasses. Not everyone wants to wear glasses and so on. But if you have that situation where the screen's there and things are popping up in your mind, you gradually dull your senses to them and you don't really notice them. It's either going to be that, or you dull your senses to the externality, the beauty and wonder of the real world, shall we say, that is out there, and you're concentrating locked in there and so on.
Yeah,
you cross the street, you'll be flattened.
Mm.
But maybe then you'll have AI cars that will actually be able to stop and not knock pedestrians down and so on. Who knows? Yeah.
Yes. So then the vision of a head-mounted displays for you to see through, that alters your perception of reality, obviously, and then your imagination now, and in the future, technology might cause problem, but there might also be AI cars. So these are speculations that we make today, but also they become part of our reality today, even for the technology or the imagined technological world that are yet to come. For example, one of my recent papers that I just submitted about extended reality is looking at it from the perspective that it has always been a futuristic technology, right? Since it's the first commercial devices, like in the 80s or something. It's never really had a real use case, but somehow people are still pursuing this thing. Similar with like AI, like people are talking about AGI a lot, that it's almost a given assumption by discussing the AI's impact on jobs, AI impact on economy in the future. So even though these things might never come true, but they are already part of our reality today. So this idea of not yet realized technical reality in the future forming a part of our reality today, I think it's being, this fact is being accelerated a lot by
while
AI.
It's still being worked on, the kinks are being got out of and so on.
And then it's pretty much like, I don't believe in AGI, right? It's probably not going to happen, but it's already having, the idea of it is already having such a huge impact.
And also an impact not just on our reality as we develop towards it, but also on our imaginary as well. And so I personally do think there will be such a thing as AGI.
Okay.
And I do hope it'll actually be something completely different to humans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'll be very, very interesting when and if that happens. I think it will work. Of course, the question is, how do you define AGI? And how, therefore, do you recognize that you've actually reached AGI? At what point do you define it as AGI? Mm-hmm. Is it simply human? Yeah? Or is it something more?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe to say it's simply human is, for the first bit, it's very arrogant to say that it's as good as it is as a human and so on. But it might also be very limiting. Maybe the intelligence could actually go far beyond that. But then what would be AI intelligence? What is the intelligence and artificial intelligence? Do you need to have embodiment of whatever the artificial general intelligence is? And so on. How would it be embodied? And would you embody it only as humans are embodied? Give it only those sensing and perceptory capabilities, or would you give it the capabilities of a dog, a cat, a plant, or whatever, and so on?
Yeah.
Why not?
So these anthropocentric imaginations is very natural for humans to, right? It's for us to imagine an AI, like in early sci-fi novels, and it's always either a robot or like a human-looking thing. And then similar with now, as I've written an article before about as well, robots, right? So you have such huge investment in embodied intelligence, humanoid robots, right? So there's absolutely no need for humanoid robots, for a robot to be humanoid, but people are still spending a lot of money on it because that's what people naturally expect for ultimate.
But you do also have canine robots. Like the, what was it, the famous Sony one from a couple of decades ago?
I mean for like education purpose? Or
Toy purposes.
Yeah.
I've seen dog robots for sort of attack dogs, for war dogs, and stuff like that and so on. So robots on four legs, basically.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But they're also sort of beetle robots and all sorts of things.
They're never getting the amount of attention that humanoid robots are getting.
No. Because we humans like to think we are splendid and isolated and absolutely unique. So whenever we sort of face with something, this is the uncanniness of something, whenever we're faced with something that is approaching human likeness and so on, that's endlessly fascinating to us.
Yeah, yes.
Because it throws a mirror back at us. What is it to be human?
Yeah. And I think that that's interesting because we've been talking before as well that human is essentially technical, like the technicity is part of human nature, with the fact that whenever we think of an ultimate piece of technology like AGI or humanoid robot, we always think of it in human term. So do you think that's a reflection of the technicity of humanity, that we ultimately perceive ourselves as the most technical being?
I think it is a mix.
Mm-hmm.
It is technicity, if you like, but I think it is also anthropocentricity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the term anthropomorphism. We like to give human characteristics to things that are not human, whether it is an animated figure some sort of animated blob with a couple of eyes and sort of maybe some proto-arms and so on. We think of it as human and so on. We like to give human emotions to our dogs and cats, even though their emotions may be very, very different, or maybe they don't have emotions, and so on, we don't know. And I think it's the same with technology, that in its in a certain advanced, a certain human-like shape, we like to put further human-like characteristics on it, further humanizing it.
With technicity being a very core concept of humanity, and then we talked about the idea of virtuality and reality. I would say, since we can agree that there is no subjective reality as how we typically describe it, what is universally true may be that technical tendency or technicity that for
quite
humans.
Possibly we are not the only creatures that have a technology. Yeah, clearly there are closely related apes that make use of certain technologies, but look at ant societies. Yeah? Bees, even birds building nests and so on, that's a technology. Yeah, termite mounds, yeah, wasp and hornet nests and so on, it's all a form of technology making use of materials, if you like, for a certain task, a certain purpose and so on, whether it serves the individual or whether it serves the society of that particular creature and so on. So let's not think we're absolutely unique and exceptional. There are others who make use of technology. But I think you're quite right in that we humans are perhaps the species that we know of so far that has most leveraged technology.
And then if you would describe the concept of reality not as like what it typically means as objectively happening and realness or whatever, then what's the closest idea of reality in humans' world?
Well, reality for me is subjective. We can never actually really know what's out there. So there is no such thing as an objective reality. It's just energy.
Right.
Whether that's some form of gravity or electromagnetism, magnetic waves or sound waves, acoustic waves or electricity or x-rays or whatever and so on. It's just energy.
So reality is energy?
Reality is subjective and within our minds, which is another form of energy you might find. It might think it's a reorganization in one form of energy of the energy of externality.
So when you say reality is subjective in your mind, then is there a collective reality?
Yeah, we have a shared reality because we have an understanding. We have this theory of mind. We recognize that we have a shared rationalizing emotional basis and a shared embodied driven way of understanding externality and so on, and therefore we have a shared language, if you like, with which to make use of metaphor, with which to describe our emotions, with which to use facial gestures to express things and so on, use our arms to express things. So we do have a shared basis for a shared reality.
We have a shared communicatable reality through language, through all that. Yeah. And I guess that's also why we have AI, which is trained based on that.
Yeah.
Right? So,
well, it's trained and based on text mainly.
Yeah. Right? Text,
this particular
as a result
type of
AI. Text as a result of human communication, which is a basically what we just described, shared reality.
Yeah.
Right. So can you say that AI is the collective reality?
You're trying to trap me. Yeah. It's always down to definitions. You could certainly describe the AI hive mind, if you like, as a form of collective reality. Now, whether you can describe it as subjective or not, because consciousness is the subjective Subjective awareness of experience. I'm forgetting my definitions and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether you can describe it as being a subjective reality, but it is another form of reality because it contains some form of knowledge, you might say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you just poked a very large hole in my arguments. I don't know. I will need to go back and think there.
Right.
I think that's a great thing about having these discussions. You're really testing me. Yeah. And I learn as much from you as you learn from me. So I think it's great.
And one of the reasons why I keep getting back to the question of reality, because whether you remember or not, in my job interview here at the end of my presentation, you were the first one who asked the question. And your question was, what is reality?
And what was your answer?
I don't know. It was because the interview was joint between CMA and IoT Thrust, so I had to make sure that the technical people can understand my answers, right? Yeah. So I talked about more in a motivational sort of aspect of
maybe that you provide a less philosophical understanding of reality for the people from IoT.
Yes,
who might be expecting you to be technology and so on.
Yeah. Who knows what I would have said if it was just you and me. But I guess we also spent the last two, three, four hours talking about this concept as well. And obviously you have more work that we can talk about, like the uncanny that we didn't really have time to talk about. But I think what we have covered so far is quite enough for a student or any audience interested in these stuff to listen and reflect on.
I agree. It's been a very invigorating discussion, and I hope someone else, as you say, finds use from it.
Yeah. And the first thing is that I hope what we said was indeed recorded, which we'll later find out again is the first trial for this potential podcast series.
Yeah.
That we run, for me personally, and also for I guess our colleagues as a group. So appreciate that you.
My pleasure.
Decided to do this with me.
Thank
today.
You for being so hard on me. Yeah.
Well, I hope I had. Yeah,
it's been fascinating. Yeah.
Well, and that, thank you very much. Brings some satisfactory. So, thank you so much.